BCG believes that creating climate solutions is the defining challenge of our generation. So we're working with leaders everywhere to understand and mitigate the cost of climate inaction. But we're also helping them find ways to innovate, build sustainable businesses, and stay competitive in an evolving world. Stick around to discover the many opportunities in a more sustainable global economy.
Welcome to Zero. I am Akshat Rathi. This week, a plan for plastic pollution. Climate change is a pollution problem. We spew too much greenhouse gases into the air and it heats up the planet. The trouble is, greenhouse gases are invisible, and that can make it very hard to describe the scale of the problem. The same is not true of plastic pollution, which is everywhere. Plastic that is littered on the land washes into the oceans, slowly breaks down into microplastics, and then travels to the furthest corners of the globe. In 2022, a study was published showing that microplastics had been found in Antarctic snow. It's also been found in every organ of the body, including the brain. Plastic is abundant and very cheap, and on current trends, the amount we produce is set to triple by 2060, from 430 million tons a year today to 1.2 billion tons, according to the OECD. And if that plastic is not managed, we'll see much more of it polluting our lands, oceans, and bodies. It's also not just about human health. There's an impact on climate. 1.2 billion tons of plastic would produce as much as 4 billion tons of greenhouse gases. So there needs to be a fix.
The deal has to ensure that we reduce the avoidable and the eliminatable, if there is such a word. But this cannot be, and some parties would like it to be, just a recycling treaty.
That's Inger Andersen, head of the United Nations Environment Programme. And for the last 18 months, she has been working on a new global treaty to reduce plastic pollution. At the end of last year, the first version of the agreement was sent to negotiators. It's called the Zero Draft, and it calls for a reduction of plastic pollution from start to finish. Not just increased recycling, but reduced production by eliminating unnecessary single-use plastics. If all goes to plan, the legally binding treaty is due to come into action by 2025. I caught up with Inger at COP28 to hear about how negotiations are going, why big companies are dropping out of their plastic promises, and why a lack of cash is as pervasive a problem as plastic pollution. Inger, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, we talk about pollution. There is a lot of invisible pollution, some we have to deal with in the atmosphere. But plastic pollution is very visible, and it's been growing and becoming a menace all around the world. So over the past 18 months, you are trying to figure out a way in which governments around the world can come together and finally have a legally binding way to address plastic pollution.
Correct.
How is it going?
Well, we've had three rounds of negotiations. The last one happened in Nairobi just a couple of weeks back. There's a zero draft text out of the treaty text. In the UN speak, it will be a treaty, but it may have other names. The instrument, as we refer to it, until it's baptized, if you know what I mean.
When you say zero draft, what does that mean?
So that means, you know, the first two sessions, the Intergovernmental Negotiation Committee, INC 1 and INC 2, the first one was spent on organizational issues and to listen to member states and other parties on their views. Second one, ditto. And it got really bogged down in silliness of procedural issues. I shouldn't say silliness, but there was quite a lot of frustration that the procedural issues took so long. But sometimes that's the case when you have 193 of your best friends negotiating, it takes time. But in the meantime, of course, we had an open submission from all governments and partners and other interested parties where they sort of submitted in response to what was called an options paper. These submissions were received, hundreds of submissions, based upon which a draft treaty text was drafted. That's a zero draft. It, from A to Z, I mean, it's an actual, you can, it's on the website, UNEP website, and it was issued in September. So that when parties gathered in Nairobi a couple of weeks ago, they had that text to refer to.
And the goal is there'll be INC 4 and 5 over the next year. And by 2025, there will be a legally binding treaty to end
plastic
pollution.
That's certainly what the enabling resolution, as it's called, back, you know, the United Nations Environment Assembly, which is sort of the Environment General Assembly, if you know, happens every 2 years. It's under UNEP's auspices. It happens always in Nairobi, which is where our headquarters is. And in the UNEA, United Nations Environment Assembly, that happened in 22, that was a decision to negotiate a legally binding instrument to end plastic pollution, comma, including in the marine environment. So it's from the entire production line, if you like, from beginning to end, not just cleaning up the oceans, not just recycling, but the entire production chain, life cycle approach. And that's what this zero draft text reflected at the last INC 3 in Nairobi. So there was a lot of comments from different interests, I have to say, and based upon which now the next round will be the true negotiation. The idea, as you rightly say, is to finish this by the end of 2024.
You said 193 best friends. Well, right now, given where multilateral negotiations are going generally, take the climate negotiations that happen at COP, they don't really act like best friends. So why do you think there is more agreement among parties, among these 193 countries, on plastic pollution than there is on carbon pollution?
I mean, I'm not saying that they're in agreement. I am saying that I have 193 bosses whom I'm trying to enable, for whom I'm trying to enable this negotiation. We can look upon it like that. However, there are also many other stakeholders who are inside the negotiating room. They're activists, they're indigenous people, they're waste pickers, they're scientists, there's private sector, etc. Why will this be more successful? I would like to believe. I think there's a popular demand for this. You know, every child saw, what was it, 10 years ago, the straw in the turtle's nose. Every child has seen, and now they're a little bit older, but the belly of the bird full of plastic, the whale full of fishing gear. Every person, especially who lives in the global south, where sanitation collection of municipal solid waste is largely absent, knows that it is the poorer people who live with waste, knows that it is the drains that are supposed to carry the rainwater out to sea that gets full of garbage and therefore blocks and causes inundation, understands that if they burn it, their children gets asthma and other diseases from burning plastic, which contains thousands of chemicals, many of which are highly toxic. So this understanding is very real. I think what we are seeing is very interesting from all sides, including sort of left and right, both aisles, proverbial aisles in politics, that there is a desire to find a solution. The on-ramp for the solutions are slightly different because some would rather focus on the recycling side and some would rather focus on a let's find a way of reducing overall production. But there is a desire to find solutions.
How would you roughly structure what is inside the zero draft and why that document as it exists, and it will of course be modified, but at least is a good start for addressing the problem of plastic pollution?
I think, first of all, what we would say is that the deal has to ensure that we reduce the avoidable and the eliminatable, if there is such a word, and that we need to think about the redesign, that we need to think about the switch to non-plastic substitutes, that we need to strengthen the systems for reuse, refill, repair, and recycle. But this cannot be, and some parties would like it to be, just a recycling treaty. As I say, we didn't need a treaty for having a fire brigade. We don't need a treaty for having a recycling system. It's obvious and it's something that we just need to do. The zero draft has to target primary polymers. It has to target chemicals of concern because we will end up having to recycle. And the recycling, therefore, we need to know what's in the stuff that we are recycling. But we also have to ensure that there's a degree of justice There are 20 million waste pickers today who make their living being the global workforce of sanitation. As hopefully we will switch to a different type of waste management, the waste pickers, when I speak to them, their aspiration is to not work on the dump, but to do house-to-house collection. If today I'm collecting metal, tomorrow I'm collecting plastic, you understand what I'm saying, so that it becomes separated at source to the extent that you can get willingness to separate in their households. That's something that we need to think about. And on the funding, there has to be a funding mechanism. Finally, I would say extended producer responsibility is something that is in the treaty. That means that there's some sort of obligation of the brand owners to have a take back scheme. Brand owners, most of them are very interested in this, but they want an equal level playing field. It can't be that in one market it's not, and in one market it is, because then it becomes unequal. We will also need to ensure that we can move stuff across boundaries that today is considered hazardous, and tomorrow it becomes wealth as we move into recycling. Then finally, if I may, legacy pollution, as what we refer to, what is already out there in our oceans, our rivers, our waterways. A small island state, Tuvalu, Fiji, etc., that lives off of tourism, just as an example, who's responsible for that beach cleanup? I met the minister from the Seychelles, and he told me the cost of the beach cleanup just to enable tourism. These are extraordinary amounts. So there has to be some justice around this in the treaty as well.
One of the features of global negotiations on environmental issues in general is that they become the place where the divide between the global north and global south is most apparent. And if you want those solutions to apply everywhere, global south countries typically require financing to be able to get those solutions going. Now, a new report from the OECD says that to be able to deal with just prevention of plastic from leaking into the environment would require more than $1 trillion of investment in non-OECD countries. In the Zero Draft and in the work that you do and end up with this treaty, how is finance fitting into trying to get these solutions going in all the places it must?
So I think we need to be careful because, of course, I live on the African continent. I'm privileged enough to live there. And it is correct that infrastructure, solid waste infrastructure, is largely absent from many, many African countries, as an example, as well as in South Asia, etc. And the costs of an engineered landfill with leachate channels, with sorting conveyor belts, all of that, and with transfer stations and the collection vehicles and all that, is considerable. But don't put that burden on the plastic treaty. You know, the plastic treaty can't carry that, but the plastic treaty in its draft text now speaks to the imperative of investments in solid waste. There, countries will have to think about the fact that once you have the investment of the infrastructure piece and the trucks and what have you, someone has to pay the bill. Because the willingness to pay, and I wouldn't, you wouldn't, if you live in a slum, you would dump because you have very little money and your priority is to feed your kids and necessities. And the luxury of paying for your garbage to be taken away is too high. So you need to find some degree of cross subsidies for that which people are willing to pay for. But on the plastic itself, the reduction itself and the alternatives itself, no, we're not talking these extraordinary costs. What we need to think about, because the poor people who may not be able to afford to buy a big container of stuff will buy whatever they need in a sachet. So that's where we've seen some really neat innovation. For example, El Gramo in Chile, where you own a bottle with your like little microchip and you go to the store and you buy El Gramo, the grams that you can afford. If you can afford 20 grams, you press the button, you get the 20 grams of whatever, soap or whatever it is that you need, and you are done, and that bottle is yours forever. It's this kind of innovation that we need to leapfrog into so that we can get rid of the plastic. I'm not denying the OECD study, but we need to think of them, and that's why I'm speaking to all the IFIs, development banks, etc. They really need to lean in on the solid waste management.
After the break, how to get companies to do the work on cutting plastic pollution.
Today's leaders face many hard choices, confronted with uncertainty, cost pressures, and growing shareholder demands. But they don't have to choose between pursuing climate and business goals. In fact, BCG research suggests that these ambitions go hand in hand. Did you know at least 40% of executives at large organizations estimate an annual financial benefit of $100 million for meeting emissions reduction targets, according to recent BCG research? BCG also found that transitioning to the circular economy could help unlock $4.5 trillion of GDP growth by 2030. The cost of inaction, however, is profound. In fact, further analysis indicates that missing climate targets could result in an average annual EBITDA reduction of 15%. At BCG, our experts recognize the myriad benefits, from risk mitigation to first-mover advantage, that come with sustainability. Let's partner to unlock a better sustainability journey.
Well, the science of climate change has been clear for a long time, and it's only become more and more certain. But that's not allowed for progress to happen at pace. That is not to say progress can't happen under the UN system. We had the Montreal Protocol back in 1987.
Another UNEP convention.
Indeed, very clear mandates to try and reduce a set of gases that were causing the ozone layer to break apart and all kinds of problems that follow from that. We've seen the result of that show over the next 30 years. The ozone hole is currently filling up and filling up quickly. So these things can work. But the same group of countries that have caused a problem on the climate sphere are also the group of countries that are trying to cause a problem on the plastics treaty. And one of the ways in which they do it is they say energy is needed for development. They were able to insert that phrase in the zero draft that was published earlier this year, where they said, yes, we'll end plastic pollution as long as it supports sustainable development. How are you going to deal with those forces?
So first of all, there are many pieces to what you said. Obviously, the producers of plastic comes from virgin raw polymer. Obviously, hydrocarbons, i.e. oil and gas, are the foundational element to produce new virgin raw polymer, which often is delivered in small nodules and can be then made into anything from airplanes to your toothbrush or whatever. The point is that many, many, many countries, way beyond the producers, have a plastics industry. Frankly, I was looking up, it's hard to find a country that does not have a plastics industry, even if it's not very big, but these are jobs. And so some of the countries are concerned about, okay, yes, this is fine, but what happens as we shift to alternatives? Will they only be made in the global north? Where's the R&D? Is there going to be justice? Will we have access to the new? I mean, these are real issues that are concerning. On the issue of new raw polymers, obviously, yes, the countries that produce the polymer could be argued that they have an interest to keep producing. On the other hand, there is an understanding even amongst their populations that recycling and recycled content is critical. They too live on oceans. They too experience this. They too have a population that objects to plastic in the waste stream. And what the zero draft speaks to, elimination of the single use. The single-use packaging, we can do a lot. And yes, obviously there are commercial interests, but I think the other force is quite strong. And you rightly pointed out the Montreal Protocol. And if I could just go back and remind listeners that in the 70s, when the theory that fluorinated gases were in fact what depleted the ozone layer, it was highly disputed by very large American companies. There was hearings in the Senate where extraordinary things were said about how this would be impossible to phase out, phase down, phase whatever. This wasn't a word at the time, but, you know, eliminate from the production. At the time, the world was told your food will spoil, your vaccines will go off, and you will be very hot because there's not going to be any cooling. And yet the industry was able to step in. There are many, many alternatives. And some are with us, but we're just not using them fast enough. And others we need to invent. And what's very interesting is that we are seeing many of the brand owners, actually, it's detracting from their shareholder value and from their company employee pride, and obviously from their brand, when their packaging is bobbing around in the water or lying on the side of the street. It is not a good thing nowadays. And so I think brand owners, many of whom I speak to at the CEO levels, are also seeking to lean in. I say to those countries that are holding on to plastic in the places where it's replaceable. We still need it for planes, trains, cars, appliances, electrical, and all of that. But that kind of plastic doesn't end up in the environment. It's the packaging that does. I say to those brand owners, look at the solar industry, PV. The early bird got the worm. Those who started investing are now controlling that market. Step in and lead in this way, so that you can be part of that innovation wave, because it will come like it came on cooling, like it came on photovoltaics.
It's clear that there are solutions and that there are places where these solutions have started to work. One solution that is popular and has scaled up is the plastic bottle fee, where you pay a little bit when you buy the bottle, and if when you return it to the right place, you get some money back. These solutions exist, they need to be scaled up. But if you just look at companies, the Ellen MacArthur Foundation listed 150 companies in 2018 that said they would report on and reduce their plastic pollution by 2025. But 5 years on, 20 companies have dropped out, many major brands, and they are unwilling to either meet the criteria or even take part in what was an obligation that seemed pretty reasonable. Why do you think a treaty, which is being talked about by governments, will actually get companies to do the work?
I'll tell you why. So I grew up in Denmark. We always had a collect scheme. When I was a kid, it was glass. And if you found a glass bottle as a little five-year-old, you would pick it up. It would be like 50 cents, I mean. And you could go and get a lollipop for that or whatever. So, and now it's also plastic. And you put them into a machine, either by weight or by individual code, and out pops a little thing that you then use to pay for your groceries. I could never walk past a can or a bottle in Denmark. It's like walking past money lying on the ground. And so what these individual companies did, they put up their hand and said, we're willing to do this. But if there is no system by which I take it all to the grocery shop or the supermarket and everything, whether it's Pepsi or Coca-Cola or Procter & Gamble, or it has to go through the same system. Honestly, it's hard for people to, this one goes here, that one goes there. It's a little bit like when you stand with your ice cream wrapping in front of the recycling and you're like, okay, is this here or is it there? And where does it go? The system has to be one that has been enabled across a jurisdiction, normally a country or a group of countries. If that is in place by legislation at the national level, logic follows. It's just how it works.
Are there countries in the world where there has been legislation put in place to deal with plastic pollution that you think are good case studies to follow? You mentioned Denmark. Are there other examples, perhaps?
I would look at Rwanda and Kenya as Rwanda came first and Kenya on its heels, and now a number of countries on the continent of Africa. Rwanda banned plastic bags, you're going to have to double check, but like 2007, and Kenya's shortly thereafter. And significant fines follow if you're caught with a plastic bag, significant in terms of or jail time. The National Environmental Management Authority of Kenya, for example, it's sort of similar to drug busts, except it's illegal plastic bag production busts. And the criminals are lined up and on Twitter, and you see them all and shamefaced and so on and so forth. You cannot, when you land in Nairobi, the air announcement will come, if you have a plastic bag, you got to leave it on the plane. Do not take it into the country. That's how it is. And it's phenomenal, I'm telling you. And so, you know, it's only bags, yes, but it's a very, very good beginning. And people are very aware of it. And we don't have, like you have in other poor countries where solid waste is absent, plastic bag trees, you know, where they have blown onto trees. Not at all. It just does not exist. And so that's, I mean, the beautification, the absence of the drainage clogging and so on. Not to say Kenya doesn't have plastic pollution, because it does, because of the packaging for cleaning products and so on. But this is the next step. Kenya, for example, is just rolling out an EPR legislation on this exact thing. Rwanda similarly, and other countries too. So yes, it's not just the North. And that's what I will probably finish with if we are coming up towards the end. That's what I would like to really stress, that this is not a North-South story. It was Peru and Rwanda that sponsored the resolution at the United Nations Environment Assembly. And then they got others to jump in, the Nordics, some of the Europeans, obviously the Pacific Islands, and more to support that resolution. So it is not just a North-South story. It is really a story led by the Global South, where the Global North has said, yeah, we can get with this. And that's quite exciting too.
Well, I wish you much luck for coming up with a global treaty in short order, and I hope we can catch up once it's done.
It'll be my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Zero. If you like this episode, please take a moment to rate or review the show on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Share this episode with a friend or with your local fly tipper. You can get in touch at zeropod@bloomberg.net. Zero's producer is Oscar Boyd and senior producer is Christine Driscoll. Our theme music is composed by Wonderly. Special thanks to Kira Bindrim, Leslie Kaufman, and Tiffany Choi. I'm Akshat Rathi, back next week.